Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So today was a community work day at the monastery this afternoon, community work afternoon. And everyone who's resident here and staying as a guest and some people from the surrounding community came together. And I just feeling quite appreciative, a lot of gratitude for the not only the work that was done, but the sense of community and the opportunity for people just to come together and share in some work activities to benefit the monastery. Gratitude for the Sangha, the benefit of being with people who are appreciative of these very special teachings. It's also nice to get out of the office, have an excuse to. I spend a lot of time doing administrative kinds of things, and there's some elders in my life used to say, "Do some good, honest work." Not that what I usually do is dishonest, but that feeling of really simple pleasures of seeing a pile of big pieces of wood get reduced to small pieces and then get stacked neatly is very tangible. It's very simple and straightforward. Speaking of honesty, honest work, honest, I've been just in the past few days or so, the topic of truth has kind of come up in several conversations. So I thought I'd maybe just mention a few thoughts around truth. Satya is the Pali word for truth. It's one of the spiritual perfections in the Theravada Pali tradition, one of the 10 perfections, truthfulness. A very important value that is an underpinning of all of our practice, I think. It can pervade our practice, the practice of truthfulness. It can pervade it on many different levels, all the way from very fundamental, basic levels of truthfulness to very sublime levels of realizing truths. On the I think everybody's quite familiar with the fundamental basic level of truthfulness in terms of precepts, refraining from lying, refraining from making conscious deception, misrepresenting the truth in a way that we're trying to get something, trying to avoid some kind of blame or difficult situation by consciously telling a lie. We take a precept against that. It's one of the first lines of truthfulness, and it provides a very strong protection for our hearts, for our minds. And the Buddha really praised truthfulness and the avoiding of telling of lies as a basic component for realizing any kind of peace of mind. So we take this precept to refrain from telling any kind of deliberate lies. Take it very seriously. There's even one of the four parajika offenses for a fully ordained monk or nun that is related to that, and that's if an ordained person tells makes any specific false claims to certain meditative attainments or any kind of transcendent attainments, if it's a false claim along those lines, then that person is no longer a monk or a nun. It's automatic disrobing offense, the most severe kind of offense in the bhikkhuni patimokkha set of rules. And then there's various other forms of permutations of that precept in the training rules as well. All of them are basically confessable offenses, so that if we find ourselves engaged in some way of telling a lie, then before the chanting of the next patimokkha, the rules of discipline, which we do every 2 weeks, it has to be confessed to another bhikkhu. So it's one that is taken very seriously. And just that in itself actually provides an enormous freedom of mind, state of mind. There's also lots of other ways that it kind of can leak out sometimes in more subtle ways. And it's after I took my bhikkhu ordination for a number of years, I found myself kind of crossing over my zone of comfort in terms of speech periodically, particularly when in an uncomfortable situation. Find myself, and I think, you know, this is not an uncommon experience, engaging in kinds of, it wouldn't be outright lying in that context or in that sense, but more of a subtle form of quick speech that was sometimes either defensive or exaggeration of kinds, things like that, so that, you know, you find yourself being admonished for something or having made an error and somebody noticing it and mentioning it to you, and it brings up a sense of shame or painfulness of having made a mistake. And sometimes the immediate reaction is one of hedging or kind of speaking, you know, with a slight trying to hide the truth, even though you're not actually telling a lie, kind of sidestepping things a bit through, you know, clever speech maybe. And it happens so fast that it's almost an automatic response in terms of trying to avoid embarrassment, avoid blame. And it's not actually a confessable offense if it's done unconsciously and so quickly that one isn't really aware of what one is doing. But it's still disturbing to the mind. Or exaggerating things, you know. How many times do we find ourselves saying something like, "He always does that"? You know, well, is that true? You know, or is it just a convenient way of giving oneself a comfortable excuse for having a certain viewpoint about somebody or trying to, you know, how easy it is for us to pigeonhole people or categorize people in a way that makes us feel, say, better about ourselves in comparison to somebody else. And so we typecast people or make judgments or make generalizations like that. You know, I found myself asking myself, well, hold on a second, you know, is he really always that way? Or does she always really do that every time? You know, well, maybe not. Or sometimes partial truths that we let happen, you know, like something that there's something happening, an expedition or a trip or something like that that sounds kind of interesting. And, you know, we volunteer to go because, you know, we say something like, oh, well, I can be of good help this way. I can help my, you know, my elders and be of service to them. And so this is my motivation. This is why I want to go, because I can be of use. Whereas in the back of our mind, we're saying, oh, I can't wait to get out of the monastery. I need a break. And so it's true in one context, but not completely true. And sometimes we have other hidden motivations that we don't express. Not that we always have to express everything that's on our minds, but just to recognize these kind of hidden tendencies that we have in ways that we hold back or exaggerate or defend ourselves in quick ways, and just watching the effect that these subtle deceptions have in our own hearts, in our own minds, maybe not being overtly harmful as in a deliberate lie, but how do they affect the mind? These little partial truths or half-truths or defensive quick statements. And I found that it was really useful experience that as I found myself, you know, as you go into this practice, as everybody knows, you become more aware of these subtle tendencies. And that's what the practice is all about. But how to deal with them when they're fairly heavily entrenched. And I found that it was just very useful in my own practice to make it part of my biweekly confession, even though it wasn't a confessable offense that I really needed to confess in order to participate in the Paddy Mocha recitation. I just felt like, well, maybe this would be a way to help develop better habits. And so for a number of years, just kind of bit the bullet, and when we were doing our confessions before the Paddy Mocha, would just include those kinds of instances that I caught myself in a defensive quick statement that wasn't maybe quite absolutely true or an exaggeration. And there was a moment of embarrassment when I would have to mention it to somebody else, but then a sense of relief. You know, it's like, okay, you know, admitting this very human quality that, you know, most people have to some degree or another, just kind of putting it out there so that I was being upfront about it. And not only did it give a real immediate sense of relief just by exposing it and seeing it for what it was to somebody else, but also gradually found that it helped bring more awareness to when it was happening or just prior to something like that happening, and to catch myself, and found myself maybe doing it a little bit less often. There's other places in the teachings that truth comes into the picture. A couple of different of the discourses where people are talking about visiting teachers from other traditions coming through and basically expounding their doctrines, trying to maybe in some cases win over converts to the teaching, or just expounding what they understand as the truth in the practice, what the practice is really all about. And the Kalama Sutta is a very famous one where that has happened to this group of people called the Kalamas, and being visited by various teachers of different traditions, each one saying, you know, this is what the practice is all about, this is what the teaching should be, you should believe this. And the Kalamas being duly perplexed as to who to believe, you know, who's telling the truth here. And, of course, the often quoted response from the Buddha basically saying that, you know, you should investigate and know these truths for yourself. When you know the truth for yourself, then you can have confidence in it by bringing it in, investigating, and knowing for oneself what is the truth. What's often forgotten when people are recalling that discourse from the Buddha is that the Buddha then also gave a very clear set of guidelines as to how to measure the different teachings that one is hearing to then come to one's own determination, and a very clear set of guidelines based on whether the practices that people were advocating resulted in the harm or suffering of others or to oneself, or to the non-harm and non-suffering of others or for oneself, and to use that as your benchmark, your guidelines, as well as a number of other guidelines that he gave in good detail. So to bring it in, to see for oneself the truth of this situation and to experience it for oneself as a way of knowing what is the truth, what is the right way. There's another sutta that is fairly well known to many people, the Chanki Sutta, C-A-N-K-I, the name of a Brahmin in the time of the Buddha who was asking the Buddha many questions about similar kind of practices that were being extolled by various teachers of the time. You know, oftentimes each one of these teachers saying, only this is true, you know, nothing else is the true practice, mine is the only way. And similar question of, like, how does one make that discernment? And then how does one preserve the truth was one of the questions he was asking. And Buddha gave a very skillful answer that if these teachers were actually really preserving the truth, then they would state the basis on which they were making their claim that the teaching was the truth. And rather than just declaring this is true, they would also declare on the basis of whether it was a teaching that they had picked up themselves on faith, or say on their particular tradition, oral tradition, or whether that it was a teaching that they had come to understand through, like, logical reasoning or reflective thought analysis, different ways that people can come to the conclusion that it's an appropriate and good and truthful practice. So that the way of preserving truth would be to say, not this is true, you should believe it, but based on my understanding, you know, through analysis or through faith or through what my teacher has told me, based on that, I have come to believe that this, you know, is a legitimate way. So that's a way of preserving the truth rather than just declaring it to be such. And then he goes on to further ask, well, how does one realize the truth? And the Buddha then goes into a very beautiful discourse of how one can find a teacher and observe the teacher under different circumstances and see whether their teachings are being, you know, realized and upheld in the person's own practice. If that person is practicing their teaching in accordance with what they're teaching, and looking at the results that it's giving, getting to know that teacher under many different circumstances. And then the Buddha relating that, yes, if that is indeed the case, then to engage with that teacher with faith and inspiration and wholeheartedly develop the practice that can be developed until the complete realization of the truth. And that's how one realizes the truth. So there are just a couple of different ways that you see this teaching come up in the suttas. Of course, there's, you know, the basic teachings of the Four Noble Truths, this, the hallmark of the Buddha's teachings, the basic outline of all of the Buddha's teachings. Pretty much all of the teachings of the Buddha can be found within the Four Noble Truths. Buddha calls it the elephant's footprint. All other footprints can fit into the elephant's footprint. And so all the teachings that the Buddha gave over the many years he taught can fit into the framework of the Four Noble Truths. And this is looking at truth from a very transcending kind of point of view, very spiritual point of view. I've been talking about this a couple of times, it seems like, the past few days or week with people too, of how easy it is in our practice to, you know, to not want to admit really even to the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So that so easy when we find ourselves in painful or difficult, problematic situations, how easy it is to fall into defense modes to avoid the pain of the dukkha of living as a sentient human being. It was somebody that I spent a fair amount of time with in a recent retreat that has been a very strong practitioner and had a lot of success and goodness coming from the meditation practice over a number of years, but was hitting a wall during this particular retreat. And over and over and over again, just having relentless, difficult, obstructive states of mind. Mara was really, really visiting full time, causing a lot of disruption. Negative states of mind and doubt to the point where, it felt like there wasn't even the experience of a moment of peace for long periods of time, and causing a tremendous amount of pain and difficulty and doubt about their own practice and the practice in general, how to proceed, and all the rational ways of trying to deal with it just weren't working. It shouldn't be like this. If I can only just get back to what I was doing before, somehow rediscover what it was, I must be missing something or forgetting something in my practice. And so I need to find a way to get back on track or to get it, get out of this, to essentially get rid of the pain of these very difficult mind states that were arising for who knows what reason. And you could see, and I could see very clearly, just because I've done the same thing myself in different ways, of that sense of just not wanting to touch that pain, not wanting to really experience it. And trying to think his way out of it through rationalization, all the while avoiding the painful truth, not willing to let it in. And something I have found useful in my own practice is when those kinds of things arise, if I've got it together enough to remember, to just ask the question, to pose the question to oneself of, okay, what's the truth here? What is the truth right now? Okay, the truth is, this is painful. I hate it. I don't want it. it shouldn't be this way. That's what I'm feeling. And to just be able to voice it and to admit it. This is penetrating, understanding the first noble truth. There is suffering. Yeah, here it is. In all of its colors. And that along with the second noble truth of what's the cause of it, to be able to say, to actually say, well, I don't want it. That's the truth also. I wish it weren't here. I would like to avoid it. I wish it would go away. That the vibhava tanha, the sense of wanting to annihilate, get rid of. So in a real practical sense, we all know what the Four Noble Truths are, but in a real practical sense, applying them, applying these truths to our experience, to really deeply allow ourselves to penetrate the first noble truth, and to really see the cause of it, this wanting to avoid pain, the wanting to have pleasure, the wanting to be something often. These are the root causes. And this is the truth, the second noble truth. that helps us understand and penetrate the first noble truth of dukkha. So this person that I was talking with tried that technique and actually found it very useful, just to be able to open up to the way things are. And even though the mind states didn't go away right away, and they even persisted, I think, for some time, there's a sense of honesty and a lack, you know, a lessening of that kind of self-deception when one is able to really look at one's experience and see it just for what it is. It's just like this, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, just like this. It's also very good to remember that there is this third noble truth, the truth that of the cessation of suffering, cessation of dukkha, and that it's possible to, in many different levels and many different ways, be relieved from that experience of suffering, unsatisfactoriness. You know, in the ways that we're just that I was just talking about, of watching the effect when one is fully honest and fully admitting to the difficulties that one is experiencing without trying to shade them over in any way whatsoever. The sense of relief and peace of mind, even if it's a temporary thing before we pick up the next thing, just by seeing something clearly, seeing something honestly, and looking clearly at the cause for it, the habitual tendency in our mind to want it to be otherwise, to want to have something that we don't have, or to get rid of something that we don't want. All of these causes of dukkha, being with situations that are unpleasant, not being with ones that are pleasant ones, all of these causes, seeing them clearly, just in and of itself, that practice results in a tremendous amount of peace of mind. And the more we do it, the better we get at it. So realizing that there is a, you know, there can be a cessation, an ending, ending to this. And also that it can go beyond the momentary psychological ease, that it can be taken further to a complete cessation of dukkha. That's reminded of the reports of a few people who went down to visit Ruth Dennison before she passed away last fall. There was a trip where Lungpa Pasano and Samanera Kantiko and Debbie and Amy, another lay supporter, went down to visit Ruth a few months before she passed away, and she was still alert enough and aware enough to give some very beautiful teachings. And one of those admonitions, in a way, one of the teachings that she gave to people was, you know, don't just settle for happiness. Happiness is fine, but there's more. There's the full path of liberation. Because, as we've all heard many times, you know, pain is impermanent, but happiness is impermanent too. Happiness in a worldly sense, or even in a psychological sense, is a temporary state of mind. And so not just to settle for that, to go, to make the effort, to go the full course. So there is that truth, the third noble truth of the complete cessation of dukkha, liberation. And the fourth noble truth that the Buddha so compassionately gave to all of us, the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha, very clearly spelled out. And the truth of it being that it is a complete path. There is nothing missing from the Eightfold Path that would prevent us from, once it's fully engaged with, to fully walk the path to completion. And the Buddha was very skillful about preserving the truth around how he taught that as well. That it was just a question that came up at another recent retreat that I was at. That someone asked, "Well, don't you know whether it's Christianity or Hinduism or Islam or Buddhism or any of the other religions? Don't all of these paths lead to the same place? Don't they, in some way or another, all lead to liberation, to nirvana, if practiced sincerely and heartfeltly?" And essentially, the Buddha never said, like, "Well, no, my way is the only way." That wasn't ever a response. But what he skillfully said was, as well, to realize the complete ending of suffering, to realize the true liberation of the heart. Whatever practice it is, whatever tradition it is, if it contains all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, then it will do that. It will lead to that place. If it doesn't have all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, then it won't lead to the complete liberation of the heart. So it's left up to the individual to determine whether their particular tradition or practice that they're engaged in has those components leading in that direction. That's preserving the truth. And, of course, that also includes, especially includes right view, which the penetration of right view is part of the Eightfold Path, which includes the understanding, realization, and deep penetration of the Four Noble Truths, of which it is a part, very neatly contained. So satya, truth, truthfulness, truth in many different ways. I think it's just so interesting and beautiful that you can see the importance of the development of this perfection, this parami. It really, when you look at it in this way, I think that you can see that if you practice working with satya, with truth, all the way from the level of precepts, honesty on a speech level, all the way through looking at the subtleties of mind habits in a truthful, honest way, and then exploring the nature of suffering in any moment or on a more broad level in one's life and one's practice, all the way to the realization of the Four Noble Truths, that really the entire practice could be seen as being contained within the practice of truth, of satya, that perfection. So we had a nice, vigorous, long work afternoon, and I think I'll leave it there for tonight's reflection.